A new book from the MSU Press continues the story of American food during the Civil War. Current State's Melissa Benmark joins me now with more. And is there something about Johnny Cake in there?
I believe there is. I'm not positive because I haven't gotten a chance to check it out yet. Just some excerpts. But last time we heard from the author, Helen Zoe Veit, on Current State, we were talking about her book that looked at the foodways of the northern states in the 1860s. Veit is an assistant professor of history here at MSU, and she's now completed the companion volume called Food in the Civil War Era, The South.
Ooh, getting hungry here.
Oh, yeah. And both of those are part of a planned food history series from the MSU Press. When I spoke with Helen Veit this week, I asked her what the biggest differences were between the two books.
Striking for me when I was looking at these sources was how much the Southern books were clearly Southern books. Whereas when I was looking through all of these Northern cookbooks, some of them published right in the middle of the Civil War, the war didn't necessarily come up that much. Sometimes there would be, you know, a very sort of oblique reference to slavery or something like that. But the war was really in the background, which to me was a reminder of how much the northern home front for many families was relatively stable. Even if they had a father or a son off fighting, dinner was still appearing on those tables most nights in a pretty recognizable form. In contrast, there were so many dramatic and, for many people, devastating changes in how they ate and what sorts of foods were available for Southerners. And you really see that reflected in Southern cookbooks.
That must have been even a little bit daunting to say, I'm going to write a book about food during a period of time where people in this region were really not seeing very much of it.
Yes, it was. I mean, it was very interesting. One of the big things that I did see was that although food changed for virtually everyone, food, you know, the way that people were eating, the kinds of foods that were available, those changes were very different depending on what class that person was and, of course, whether that person was enslaved or not. So for, you know, the very wealthiest Southerners, although they might, you know, certainly by the end of the war, they weren't able to get imported citrus, they weren't, sometimes getting salt or coffee, they were still eating enough. You know, they were getting adequate calories, even if those were coming in a different form. The very poorest Southerners suffered much more. And one thing that you have to remind yourself when you're encountering these sources is that in most cases, it was the wealthy people who left the sources. So when we have cookbooks or periodicals talking about food, in many of those cases, they were still being written by people who had roughly adequate calories. And so you hear sort of distant reports of people starving in the mountains, or we know from other sources, for example, that African American death rates were astronomical during the war because of deprivation and, you know, exposure and sickness and things like that. But ironically, looking at the cookbooks themselves, even the ones that are talking about downward mobility or, you know, how can we make coffee with you know, parched okra seeds, those were still people in a position of relative luxury.
Now, were you looking at only published cookbooks, or were there, like, for instance, people's handwritten recipes in there and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so that was interesting. In the North, there were enough sources on cooking that I really just stuck to published cookbooks. In the South, there was only one cookbook published in the entire South in the middle of the war, and
wow,
that one was a really slim volume. That's very interesting in and of itself. But I also looked at other sources. One of the biggest and most revealing sources were the recipes and the articles about food that were published in Confederate periodicals. These were journals that, you know, were aimed really at the whole family, that would have gone to planters or to yeoman farm families, that dealt with a variety of topics about farming and planting, but that also talked a lot about food. And so looking, you know, month by month, as you can look in periodicals, about the deterioration of the food situation was fascinating. I also included recipes from this fascinating handwritten recipe manuscript that is in MSU's special collections that is actually from Northern Maryland, as far as we can tell. You know, and this is a good reminder that for many people living in Maryland, it was very much a Southern state, but one that, because Abraham Lincoln worked very hard to prevent it, never joined the Confederacy. So that's a fascinating collection of recipes that had never before been published in any form.
Of course, there's the issue that most slaves couldn't read or write. So did that mean that the African-American recipes didn't get preserved over the years as much?
That's certainly true to a large extent. We know, I mean, one thing that we know a little bit is the standard rations that many enslaved people were fed, precisely because they talk about them in these Confederate periodicals. You know, what are you feeding your slaves? I find that a diet of cornmeal and molasses is adequate. Oh, I feel that you must add bacon, etc. But one of the, I think, most fascinating parts is that the foods of the very most elite Southerners, we have some gaps in our knowledge precisely because the people doing that cooking, the enslaved cooks, were kept legally illiterate. And so after the war, that whole body of culinary knowledge suddenly was scattered all over the place because it was just in the minds of these individual people, usually these individual women who in many cases left the South. And one of the volumes that we reproduce in this book is what Mrs. Fisher knows about old Southern cooking. This was a really fascinating cookbook that was published in the early 1880s, and it was transcribed recipes from a woman named Abby Fisher who had been an enslaved cook in the South. And she moved to California after the war. She and her husband started a pickle business. And they found a group of women who became fascinated by her experiences in the South, and they helped her transcribe these recipes and get them published. So we reproduced that cookbook in its entirety in this book.
I suppose one thing from that era was that there was always a level of assumed knowledge that, you know, cook a chicken, for instance, you know.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the funny things is that a lot of these cookbook authors, they apologize and they say, I am so sorry that these recipes are so tediously minute. You know, we include so many details and, you know, this will be boring to experienced cooks. And I look at the recipes and I said, what? Where are the details? You know what? I have no idea what you're talking about here. A lot of them will barely include any instructions at all. In fact, sometimes recipes literally just have a list of ingredients, and that's the recipe. Or sometimes they have no ingredient quantities, and they give very vague instructions and then expect that the cooks will know how much of each ingredient to use.
There must have been some nostalgia at the end of the war and after the war for the kinds of pre-war food that Southerners had eaten. Was there a particular dish that just seemed to be like almost an institution that you can think of that people, you know, missed having and remembered fondly?
That's interesting. I mean, I think during the war, there was a lot of nostalgia for foods that they couldn't get, especially foods that needed salt. Salt was one of the first commodities to disappear from the Confederacy. So salted foods like ham and bacon just became almost impossible to get during the war. But by the time that cookbooks were being published after the war, you know, a lot of those foods were available again. And so although the cooking of the Old South was nostalgically celebrated, in practice, a lot of those recipes were still being eaten. What people did celebrate nostalgically, and this is funny, but it's precisely those war recipes, the recipes of having to do without. So even the cookbooks that were published right after the war in the late 1860s for Southern food often included recipes like blockade coffee, you know, how to make coffee without coffee, how to make cream without cream, you know, you use egg whites, how to make, you know, wheat bread without wheat. And one of the things that was interesting to me was how quickly people celebrated the deprivations of the war itself as a regional badge or, you know, a sort of shared hallmark of what they'd gone through together.
Well, Helen Zoe Veit, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.